Thanks for coming to my session. This is Being the Church in Other Contexts, and part of it is going to be evangelism and discipleship overseas. I'm going to spend a lot of time talking about how one senses a call and prepares for being a missionary overseas. My name is Greg Allison. I teach systematic theology here at Southern Seminary. I teach all the core courses, as well as elective courses in the doctrine of the church, Roman Catholic theology, historical theology, the doctrine of scripture, and human embodiment. So those are some of my areas of interest. My wife and I spent a total of 18 years on the staff of CRU, Campus Crusade for Christ, and seven of those years, come on up, there's one up here, yeah. Seven of those years were in Italy, particularly in Rome, and in Lugano, Switzerland. Lugano's part of the Italian-speaking part of Switzerland. Let's begin with prayer. Lord, thank you that you call us to yourself and that you also call us into ministry. And sometimes that involves calling us to be the church in other contexts. Lord, thank you that even here in this room are represented men and women who have sensed your call or who will sense your call to be missionaries, to take the gospel, to plant churches in regions other than North America. Lord, I pray that they would be blessed by this time and help to prepare for their overseas experience. I pray all of us would understand better what it takes to move outside of our current cultural context to serve you. We pray that you would be pleased with our time. In Christ's name, amen. Let me say, you are free to interrupt, ask questions, make comments anytime you want. Just raise your hand. But if you're a verbal processor, you want to repeat everything I say in your own words, you can't do that. All right, it's got to be on target. Let's begin with what usually comes first in a movement to become someone who does evangelism and discipleship overseas. And that is a divine call to be a missionary. We see this biblically in Acts 13, 1-3. Now there were in the church at Antioch prophets and teachers, Barnabas, Simeon, who was called Niger, Lucius of Cyrene, Manaen, a member of the court of Herod the Tetrarch, and Saul. While they were worshiping the Lord and fasting, the Holy Spirit said, "Set apart for me Barnabas and Saul for the work to which I have called them." Then after fasting and praying, they laid their hands on them and sent them off. Here we see a very clear example of the Holy Spirit consecrating these two men, calling them specifically to leave the church that they had founded at Antioch and plant churches by preaching the gospel and discipling men and women in other contexts. And so the first step in moving overseas and being the church in another context is sensing a divine call, which can be mysterious, can be mystical, it can be a strong inner conviction, it can be a matter of a simple phone call or direction from someone in authority. In 1976, my then fiance, now my wife Nora, and I were finishing up the university studies, and we had been accepted on the staff of Campus Crusade for Christ, and we were about 2 weeks away from getting married. And we had received permission from CRU to begin raising our support, so we visited a businessman and his wife in a small town just outside of South Bend, Indiana. And as we shared our future ministry with CRU, with this couple, we had a great time talking about what we anticipated doing, talking about our need for prayer and finances. And in the midst of the conversation, the businessman looked at us and he said, "Wouldn't it be interesting if you and your future wife would be assigned to the University of Notre Dame," which of course is in South Bend, Indiana. And we laughed. Yeah, the Protestant Missions Organization, CRU, doing missionary work on the campus of the premier university, Catholic University in the United States. Like, that's going to happen. Half an hour goes by. We finish up our conversation. Nora gets into our 1966 dark green Oldsmobile 88 She gets in on the passenger side. I get on the driver's side. And, you know, this is a super, like, wide yacht, boat. So we wave across the way. It's that huge. And we look at each other and we say, God is calling us to the University of Notre Dame. It was an inner sense, a conviction very strong in both of our hearts. So we get married a week or two later, take our honeymoon going out to Southern California for our training with crew. And during that training, we receive a placement form. Where would you like to be on staff with Campus Crusade for Christ? And we wrote, we want to go to the University of Notre Dame. A couple days later, the principal's office, you know, our leaders, called us down and said, well, that's very interesting that you're sensing a call to the University of Notre Dame because we want to start the ministry there. But, and we're looking for a couple, but you don't meet our three requirements. First of all, you're not Catholic. You don't have a Catholic background. And we really want that to be the case to launch a ministry of Campus Crusade at Notre Dame. Secondly, you're not veteran staff. And we only launch new ministries with vets, and so you don't qualify. And thirdly, the couple that is actually going to lead the team has two kids. You just got married 3 weeks before, and you don't have any kids yet, do you? No. So strike one, strike two, strike three, you're not going to go to the University of Notre Dame. 10 days later, we get a second placement form. Where do you want to be on staff of Campus Crusade? We believe that God is calling us to the University of Notre Dame. It's now like a day later, and we get called down to the principal's office. What didn't you understand about the word no? You're not going to the University of Notre Dame because you don't meet our three requirements. We said, we'll go wherever you want, but God's calling us to the University of Notre Dame. 10 days later, third placement form. Where do you want to go? University of Notre Dame. It's now like panic. 4 hours later, the principal calls us down to the office and goes, you're not going to the University of Notre Dame. Maybe Villanova or some other Catholic university, but you're not going to the University of Notre Dame. We said, we'll go wherever you want us to, but we believe that God is calling us to the University of Notre Dame. 10 days later, we receive our placement envelope, kind of the mission impossible thing. Here's your mission, should you decide to accept it. We go under a palm tree. It's 7:30 in the evening, Southern California, beautiful evening. And we are required to open the envelope and then observe a 24-hour period of silence. We can't talk to anyone. We can just pray, seek God's confirmation, and so forth. We open up the envelope, take out the letter, and it says, your mission, your assignment is the University of Notre Dame. Now, even the principal has to observe 24 hours, right? But he does call us down right away, and he said, your clear call to go to the University of Notre Dame outweighed any of the obstacles that we thought were in your way. So a call like that may be how God directs you to be the church in another context, to do evangelism and discipleship overseas. We spent 2 years at the University of Notre Dame, had a wonderful ministry. At the beginning of our second year, we had 250 Notre Dame students who wanted to be involved in Bible studies. We had room for 150. I was leading 4 or 5 Bible studies. My wife was leading 3 or 4. It was incredible, the movement of God. But at that moment, crew was also really interested in moving staff overseas. And so one day I was coming back from the South Bend Library, and I had in my arms books on Italy, the Italian culture, and the Italian language, because Nora and I had signed up for a 10-week summer project that coming summer in Rome, Italy. And so I come into the house, and my wife meets me with the phone. Now, in those days, phones used to be connected to cords. And we had an extra long cord, so she, like, met me as soon as I came into the door. And she said, you better talk to them. And it was some of our international representatives. And they said, it's interesting that you've been to the South Bend Library to get books on Italy, the Italian culture, and the Italian language, because your next assignment for the next 5 years, you'll be the campus director in the University of Torino, which is in northwest Italy. That was a phone call. That was no conviction in our heart. It was a phone call to move us overseas. Now, honestly, I've never stepped foot in the city of Torino. I was never the campus director at the University of Torino. But that call got us to move overseas to Italy, and we ended up studying the language in Florence for 6 months and then 3 very fruitful years in the city of Rome. So all this just to say, a call to be the church in other contexts, a call to be a missionary overseas, can come in various ways. It doesn't have to come in one particular form. Comments from you, questions about this? Go. Yeah.
Just kind of thoughts with that. I think that we're on the same page, but, you know, you just
wait
on the
door.
Like, what do you think that could possibly
require? Yeah, even when I interviewed here to come to Southern, which was 10 years ago, I became strongly convinced that we needed to make the move. And my wife, who was studying Louisville, Kentucky, found out that the key industries are bourbon, horse racing, and cigarettes. Yeah, we really want to go there. Yeah, we were in Portland, Oregon at the time. She gradually gained the conviction that I had, but it started out of her heart of submission. If you really have a clear sense from the Lord, then I know that He's not only calling you, but He's also calling me and calling our children along with. But I wouldn't rush. I would give it time to percolate. Are you more strongly convinced, or is he more strongly convinced at this point?
I think we're both convinced, but I think it's in almost different ways.
Yeah, I think patience is a good thing, yeah. And a theme to which we'll return is this strong sense of urgency, which is really, really good. We know there are lost people all over the world who will die without Christ unless we go. And there must be, and it's right to have a sense of urgency. But don't get ahead of God either. We need God-called men and women. We don't need just living, walking, talking bodies. Hot bodies, warm bodies overseas usually are disasters. You need some kind of sense of divine direction for this, and not just a sense of urgency. When those two combine, I think you have a very powerful reality to face. We looked at the call. What about the character? Thinking about the kind of people that we need to be the church in other contexts, what do we find biblically? And I want us to look at 1 Timothy chapter 3, verses 1 to 7, part of which is up on this slide, part is on the next slide. And this is the description of the qualifications for a pastor or elder or overseer or bishop. All these words are interchangeable. And this is the kind of person that we need overseas. Paul writes, "The saying is trustworthy. If anyone aspires to the office of overseer, pastor, elder, he desires a noble task. Therefore, an overseer must be above reproach, the husband of one wife, sober-minded, self-controlled, respectable, hospitable, able to teach, not a drunkard, not violent, but gentle, not quarrelsome, not a lover of money. He must manage his own household well, with all dignity, keeping his children submissive. For if someone does not know how to manage his own household, how will he care for God's church? He must not be a recent convert, or he may become puffed up with conceit and fall into the condemnation of the devil. Moreover, he must be well thought of by outsiders, so that he may not fall into disgrace, into a snare of the devil." We could spend hours looking at these qualifications, but let's just highlight a few of them. Notice the first, if anyone aspires to this office, he desires a noble task. Something that we're looking for in terms of a character is there a desire? Is there an aspiration to be a missionary? Is there a desire to become part of the church in another context? Sometimes we wrestle with this. We say, well, if anyone really desires to be a missionary, what? Maybe they're getting ahead of God, or maybe they're just doing their own thing. But really, God does call, and God gives us a sense of desire or aspiration, and that's a good thing. So we should be looking for people who have a desire to be the church in other contexts. Paul says that this person must be above reproach. I think this is kind of the umbrella term. And then Paul specifies what it looks like for a missionary to be above reproach in the following characteristics. He must be above reproach, that is, the husband of one wife, sober-minded, self-controlled, respectable, and so forth down the line. So above reproach, we're looking for people not perfect, not sinless, but whose tenor of life, whose characteristic, general characteristic of life is one that if there's a charge, an accusation, it falls flat. It doesn't stick. It's like Teflon-coated pan. It you throw it at it and it doesn't stick. Husband of one wife or wife of one husband, faithful to the highest human commitment that one makes in this world. Skip ahead to hospitable, one who welcomes strangers, one whose heart and home is welcoming to others. This doesn't mean an extroverted character. It may, but even introverts can learn to be hospitable. My former dean at Western Seminary, where I used to teach, is the most introverted person I've ever met. To give you an idea, for his birthday one year, I gave him the gift of money to take himself out alone for lunch. And he said, "This is one of the greatest gifts I've ever received." But he learned to be hospitable because he had a wife who knew how to be hospitable, and he opened his heart and he opened his home, even though it was against every fiber in his own being. So it's not extroverted in character, but able to welcome others, able to teach. That is, we're looking for people to do evangelism, discipleship, plant churches in other contexts who are able to communicate the good news and teach sound doctrine. This is not teaching math and physics and education and business, but it's sound doctrine, the gospel of Jesus Christ, truth, the whole counsel from the Word of God, to be able to lead people to Christ and nourish, foster people in the faith of the church, able to teach. Then there's several negative qualities, not a drunkard, not violent, but gentle, not quarrelsome, not a lover of money, not addicted, not persistent in these wrongful areas. He must manage his own household well, because if he doesn't know how to manage his own household, how will he care for God's church? So we look for someone who has managerial abilities at the microcosmic level, because that's a good indicator that this person will have managerial abilities at the macrocosmic level of the church. So we look at a person's family life. Is he able to lead well, manage well his spouse and his children? If so, that's a good indicator that when asked to manage and lead the church, he'll be able to step up from the microcosmic level to the macrocosmic level. Now, it's no guarantee, but it's a strong indicator. How about those of you who are single? What do we look for in you? Are you a public school or Christian school educator? And in public school, you have 49 kids, and in private school, you got 17. But are you able to manage your classroom well? Do you run a business? Are you a businessman or a businesswoman? How do you treat your employees? Are you in it for dishonest gain? Do you serve and offer services well? Are you able to manage at the microcosmic level, looking then that as an indicator of ability to manage at the macrocosmic level? Must not be a recent convert. We definitely don't need new believers in positions of church planting, evangelism, and discipleship overseas. It's a heady thing If you've done overseas work, you realize it's both humiliating and it's heady. And heady things go to the heart of a young believer and cause problems. More than likely, he or she will fall into the condemnation of the devil. We'll just wipe out. Moreover, he must be well thought of by outsiders. It's not just a good reputation with people inside the church, but a good reputation as well with people who are outside of the church. So again, there's no complaints, no legitimate charges that can be brought against this person and the church. Pause here. Questions, comments from you? Yeah, sure. So a heady believer who moves into a place of responsibility gets puffed up. You know, he's been a believer for a year and a half, say, and is moved into, let's say, just in our own context, a leadership position in a church, or is moved overseas and bears a lot of responsibility. It becomes a point of pride and puffs this person up. We want to make sure that there's a seasoning that takes place before we move people into church leadership, before we move people overseas into other contexts, so that it doesn't go to their head, they don't get puffed up with pride, and they don't wipe out. Go ahead. It's not so much chronological, but spiritual development. So you could theoretically have a man or a woman who is 2 years as a Christian, who has absorbed the Word of God, walked faithfully and obediently with the Lord, being led by the Spirit, engaged in ministry, highly competent. And so you say, we don't want to put a five-year chronological limit on it, but how about the maturity level? I think that's what we're most looking for. Yeah.
In an overseas church planning context, obviously you do have to put a lot of new Christians in positions of leadership.
Yeah. And that can be problematic. I mean, I had been on staff with Crew for 2 years only before I moved into a leadership position. I was team leader for our team in Rome. And there was just all kinds of stuff I had not done here. Counseling was my demise. Cross-cultural counseling is hard anyway, isn't it? So the more ready, the more seasoned here, the greater, not a guarantee, but the greater probability that there'll be fruitfulness and staying power overseas.
What about the locals?
Oh, about locals. Yeah, that's the perennial question, isn't it? When do you hand the football off? There are different philosophies. There's one where, you know, you need to be there 10, 15, 20 years. In my case, I was team leader in Rome. I did a training center for 3 months, and the day that we finished the training center, I handed over the keys of the directorship to an Italian man that I had discipled for and trained for those 3 months. Just because the desperate need for an Italian to lead in that context. And I knew all along that my goal was to work myself out of a job ASAP. And it took only 3 months. But that's good, because then I was in a serving role, not a leading role, which is, I think, important for missionaries. Competency, we look to call. Character. How about competency? Here's a basic principle. There are exceptions to it, but a basic principle. What you are gifted at and fruitful in here, you will be gifted at and fruitful in there. I'm talking here in our context, there in another context. What you are gifted at and fruitful in here, you will be gifted at and fruitful in there. What you're gifted at and fruitful in here, you will be gifted at and fruitful in there. Vice versa. is true. What you are not gifted at and not fruitful in here, you will not be gifted at and not be fruitful in there. So the lesson is expose yourself to as many aspects of the ministry here while you can, before you go overseas, before you become the church in another context. Expose yourself to every aspect, as many aspects of the ministry here. Engage in evangelism, discipleship, leading small groups, coaching leaders of small groups, counseling, worship leading, teaching, administration, showing mercy, giving. Do it all. Now, if you're me, you're not going to do worship leading. I couldn't even make the choir in sixth grade, and there were a handful, two of us, that didn't make it out of 60. So I'm not a worship leader. So I don't get involved in that, but you get the idea, right? Where you have some ability, be involved in that. What you're looking for is confirmation on in your own heart and confirmation on the part of others that you probably have a gift or gifts in these various areas. Because then you'll want to develop those areas. Because when you're overseas, you will be gifted at and fruitful in those areas as you were here. This isn't to say, again, this is a general principle. There are exceptions. I'm completely negated for administration. I wish I had gained some kind of gift of administration when I was working overseas, but I did not. So you can't count on it. But if you are gifted at, fruitful in ministries here, most likely you'll be gifted at and fruitful in ministries overseas as well. So I would encourage you to go to seminary. I was just talking with one person who's in this room two nights ago, and we calculated that she probably has 43 more years of ministry ahead of her. How about an investment of 3 years in seminary? Less than 10% of her remaining ministry years, less than 10% invested in seminary to gain a toolkit, Bible, theology, counseling, evangelism, discipleship, teaching, preaching, etc., gain a toolbox that won't be exhaustive, but will lay down the tracks for you for the rest of your life. But Jesus is coming back again in 3 years. And the last thing I want in the world is, as I'm walking across the stage to get my MDiv diploma, Jesus returns, and I've wasted all 3 years. Well, if you know when Jesus is going to return, would you please share the secret with all of us? And then read Mark 13:32, which says, you don't really know. It may be a good guess, but it's only a coincidence if you get it right. Take short-term mission trips. Before you go and be the church overseas, before you engage in church planting, evangelism, discipleship overseas, do a 2-week, a 4-week, a 6-week, a 10-week short-term or medium-term mission trip where you can see your abilities. Do you have the ability to cross into another culture? Or as soon as you get there, do you think, oh, this is just completely wrong? Journeyman service. If you're in the Southern Baptist Convention, you know about journeymen. It's interesting, no, they don't call them journeywomen, but journeyman service is a 2-year period of time. That's an excellent test period, both for you and for the International Mission Board, to see if you've got what it takes to be the church in another context. Questions? Call, character, competency? Yeah, go ahead. Not at all. It was only what I could gain myself. Okay. Yeah, yeah. So my wife and I worked in a marginal Catholic context. I mentioned that we were planning to go for a summer term to Rome. We did. Went to the University of Rome. And we didn't know any Italian other than pasta and, you know, ciao and things like that, which could say hello and get us to eat, but that was about it. But we did learn a very important phrase talking to every student we talked with at the University of Rome, and that was non credo in Dio, I don't believe in God. 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 They were all communists. They're all Marxists, all atheists. And even before going over for that short-term mission trip, we'd sensed that God was calling us to a marginal Catholic context like we had worked at Notre Dame. And so we weren't crew staff at a university. We're crew staff in Rome, basically, working with marginal Catholics. And then we attended, you know, the typical Protestant evangelical church, which was 30 people on a good Sunday, pastored by a butcher or baker or a candlestick maker who had the Bible in one little commentary, never been to past junior high or high school education, and it didn't nourish our soul. So you've got to be self-feeders, is that word communicate, self-feeders on the word, or, as I will encourage you later, be part of a team that can be accountable for one another and nourish one another.
Can you speak to the short-term experiences and term of calling?
Yeah.
Particularly have in mind, for example, I've been short-term work in Kenya.
Yeah.
I've loved it. Yeah. Amazing.
Yeah.
Wonderful. I do not feel called to Kenya because of the need in Kenya. And for example, if we're the short-term experiences that are available to particular students or people in that situation, if we only go to those places since we have a calling there, the gospel's never going to get to you at the end.
Yeah.
Can you kind of speak to, I know students, friends, that they went on one trip to one place, it was amazing, and that's all they've gone back to, and they want to stay there forever, and that's great, but I'm also wondering, especially with unreached people groups, how do we put together the short-term experience with the call?
Can you become a part of a short-term missions experience in these unreached areas?
That's what I'm saying. You can't go to a, you know, BSM crew or whatever and say, hey, we're taking a trip to Afghanistan. You may die. You know,
yeah.
We're working with this person. Like, you can't do any of that.
So, why not? Why can't you do that?
That just doesn't happen. It's too dangerous, or the country won't let them in. You can't go. I mean,
yeah,
talking about,
yeah. I see, yeah, yeah. So the future ministry target area is not reproducible before you go there. Is that what you're saying? Yeah. So in that, I would still encourage other short-term missions trips just to see a general ability to cross into cultures, pick up language, adjust, things like that, to kind of a trial balloon for that. But then specifically seek a strong call from the Lord to go into that context, into an unreached area, because you won't experience before you get there. But the only way you're going to stick through it, through the thick and thin, is to know that God has called you there. So I would particularly pay attention to a strong call from God to go to that context. Yeah. Yeah, good.
It is hard for us to go to many places to feel that call. However, I think if you really sit down and look, you'd be hard pressed to find a country in the world that's not represented in any of the calls.
That's good. Good.
So working with people, getting to know people from a country like Saudi Arabia. Working with them, that's
great. Thank you very much, yeah. So find people groups that you would be reaching who are here. Yeah, that's a very good suggestion. Thank you. The call, the character, the competency, and now we need a confirmation. Just to make sure that this call and these abilities are not just the fruit of indigestion from the pizza that you ate the night before. You need external confirmation by others that God is indeed calling you, God has indeed gifted you, and God is indeed placing you in this to be the church in another context. There are various assessments that are out there in terms of spiritual gift inventories, church planting assessment tools that are both, you can pay for them. There are also free ones. There are lots of those that are available. I would say avail yourself of these diagnostic tests to see if this is something you should think about, continue to think about. Talk to your family. Now, when your family is a non-believing family, of course, they're going to say, this is absolutely ridiculous. For example, when my wife and I sensed the call to go overseas, my father-in-law, who was a non-believer, stepped in and he said, basically, what is it going to take for me to do so that you don't go overseas? I will buy you a home. I will pay for your seminary education. Is that enough? Oh, you want to learn another language? Well, there's a lot of Hispanics down over here in this part of our town. Just learn Spanish if that's what you want to do. Get it out of your system. So with non-believing parents, there's usually not a lot of understanding. With believing parents, there's not a lot of understanding. So my parents, who were believers, they did not track with this at all. And I'm in the situation now where my middle daughter and son-in-law and two grandkids who are here finishing up the seminary, they want to be missionaries in Mumbai, India. There's not much I can say. I did it to my parents. They're going to do it back to their parents. So what goes around comes around. But family members, both non-believers and unbelievers, can see a lot of character flaws, a lot of holes, a lot of things we're not thinking about. Don't minimize their input. Don't just neglect it or push it aside. Listen carefully. There is wisdom in a lot of counselors. Listen to your family members. There's no one who knows you better. Your friends, ask them. Say, you know what, I sense God's call to be the church in another context. I sense God's call to be a church planter, to engage in evangelism, discipleship, overseas. And there's this need out here in Saudi Arabia. And here's a job description. Look at this job description. Do you think it fits me? And the response may be, wow, they must have written the job description for you. Because you match up in almost every category. Or this is the job description and you think you can do that? You don't have any of these gifts or abilities. What are you thinking? Friends who know you well, friends with whom you are in an accountability relationship, listen to them carefully. Your church should be observing you in the ministries that you're engaged in your character, in your competency, in your call. Listen to your church. And if you're a leader in a church, please pay attention to people in your congregation whom you sense God may be calling. But would you recommend them well? Just because a guy or a gal likes to study the Bible and maybe shares his or her faith like once a month doesn't mean that that man or that woman is called to be a missionary. Recommend well, and not just everyone who like establishes or shows himself or herself to be outstanding in biblical aptitude and theological soundness and all like that. Recommend well. And of course, then there is your missions agency, which will take you apart piece by piece and put you back together again. That's all very good. I know the IMB has, 18-month process at least? And you go, man, this is just so hard. But the idea is they don't want to make a mistake. They don't want to place you in an overseas context where you wipe out. They want to make sure that you're placed in the right area. And all those are very, very valuable confirmations. Comments, questions about this? Okay.
What types of things should we do? I mean, obviously, there's for different people that go to different locations, but what type of main things should we be looking for when we partner with organizations to go?
Mostly ministry goals and philosophy. Do they match up with your ministry goals and your ministry philosophy? So let's say your ministry philosophy is to go overseas with the team to plant a church. The ministry philosophy of the missions agency is to send individuals to do media work or research work with unreached people. You don't jive. So you're looking for similar goals, philosophies, things like that. That's I think, the key thing. Other things that we look for, matching up with a missions organization. Usually it's the one that you work with, like on short-term missions or most familiar with. People recommend it and all like that. And there are strengths and weaknesses of all missions agencies. So it's not like you're looking for the perfect one, but the one that most resonates with who you are, what you want to do, your ministry philosophy and target and things like that. The logistics of moving to be the church in another context. And these are not necessarily in any order. But part of it is raising support. Now, unless you're with the International Mission Board. And the genius of the IMB is, one of the things that is genius about the IMB is that it provides for you. If you're with the IMB, let me plead with you, don't become arrogant because everything is taken care of. And remember, it is a very efficient system. You don't take 6 months or a year or 3 years to raise support. That's true. But I don't think efficiency is a core biblical value. God himself is certainly not efficient in terms of let's hurry the process along. Let's cut corners. Efficiency is not a core biblical value. It may be a core American value. And yeah, it's nice to be able to say, I don't have to spend 18 months or 3 years to raise support. But don't be arrogant about it. And remember, those who have to spend 18 months or 3 years to raise their support get to meet incredible people that they would never meet otherwise. People will pray for them. Perhaps they're people they will lead to the Lord. People that may be attracted to overseas missions through them. So there are different things going on with different philosophies. IMB, pioneers, you may not raise support, you may have to raise support. That would be another good thing. How do I know I should go with this missions agency? If you're negated for raising support, don't go with a missions organization that says you've got to raise your own support. Most likely you're not going to raise it. So raising support is one of the logistics. International missions training. Sometimes we balk against this. We don't want to go through training. But you want to be as well prepared as you can. And most missions agencies have wonderful international missions training. So soak it up. Don't just see it as a hoop you've got to get through, but be formed by that training. Most missions agencies know pretty much what you're going to need and believe them when they're training you for those matters. Those areas of training will come to help you. Team building. Some of you want to do the Lone Ranger thing, and there are some missions organizations that have that mentality. We send individuals. I personally don't like that. I think there is incredible openness to failure. It's a recipe for disaster. So rather than Lone Ranger ministries, look to be part of a team. And if at all possible, while here stateside, before you become the church overseas, build a strong team. Build a strong team. Recruit strong, gifted people that will join you, link arms with you to be the church in another context. What you want is synergy. So different people, different strengths, different gifts, working together, synergy, coming together to make a strong team. Now that means if you're the leader of the team, you've got to be a strong leader and not be threatened by strong men and women on your team. That's okay. If you have men and women who are stronger than you are, but you have the responsibility to facilitate and guide that team, be thankful that the other members of your team are more fruitful and stronger than you are. There's nothing wrong with it. It's not about you. It's about developing and launching a team for the communication of the gospel and the establishment of the church. There are documents to get, passport, visas. get every visa that you need. My wife and I finished up the MDiv at Trinity in 1985, and we were assigned by CRU to Lugano, Switzerland, the Italian-speaking part of Switzerland, to engage in our ministry there. So we talked, this is pre-email, obviously, we talked on the phone or we sent aerograms, no one knows what those are, aerograms to our staff in Italy and in Switzerland saying, you know, tell us all the documents we need. And they get us back a list of documents, and we conversed with the Italian consulate in Chicago, and we said, what other documents do you need? We said, well you need this particular visa. We talked to our people in Italy and Switzerland. They say that we need this visa. Do we need this visa? No, you don't need that visa. You sure we don't need that visa? No, you don't need that visa. None of us have that visa. You don't need that visa. Come on over. Fly over, get there, and guess what? Of course. It costs us $3,500 to fly, and this was in the day, $3,500 to fly back and forth for a 10-minute visit to the Italian consulate in Chicago to get the visa. There's two responses, despair or God is sovereign. It does nourish belief, trust in the sovereignty of God. But you can avoid that. And remember, documents to be obtained in an overseas context are notoriously difficult to gain. And so be prepared for rejection, for misunderstanding, for miscommunication. I know some friends that we work with in Italy. They've moved their car from France to Italy. They had to register their French car in an Italian context. They went through 21 different documents. Right? It took them 7-8 months, at the end of which the last person in line took a crock of glue and just glued every page, 21 pages on top of each other. The wife is just going to go hysterical. The husband says, don't laugh, because if they hear you laughing, they'll rip them up and we'll have to start all over again. There are a lot of crazy hoops, but that's life overseas. Leaving well. Make sure you have good closure with your family, your friends, and your church. And grieve well. You will not see them for a year or 3 years. And yeah, there is Skype and all these incredible technological advances now. But it's not wrong to grieve well, because you will not have that constant contact. That's okay. And settle in well. Take time for an initial adjustment. I know, you know, the adrenaline is flowing and you want to get to language learning and get to evangelism, discipleship. You want to plant your first church in 6 months. That's not going to happen. Adjust well. Take time for adjustment. And realize that there's a honeymoon period that you will go through that will come to a crashing halt. It may be 3 months. It may be 6 months. It may be a year. During that honeymoon period, everything is great. The new culture is fascinating. Everything the Italians do is way better than the Americans ever did. I wish I were an Italian. I love this and all. And that will come to a screeching halt, where everything that used to amaze you and cause you wonder, it'll all be sickening. And you've got to get through that honeymoon period, and you've got to get through the crash and burn period to settle in life in another culture. And what I learned, again, just a general principle, the first friends that you make in a new culture are not likely to be long-term key people. The first friends you meet and make in a new culture are most likely not going to be long-term key people, because they're the ones that are fascinated with Americans and usually a little bit weird in their own culture. They're outsiders to their own culture. They see you as an American. They love Dallas and all these other TV programs that they see. They're fascinated with Americans, but they're outsiders to their own culture. They're probably not going to become your key leaders. So watch an overinvestment in the people who the first day meet you and, you know, basically say, oh, you're going to be, you know, great. Most likely they're not going to be your key people. Comments on logistics? Yeah. you're in your 20s, so your parents are how old? In their 60s. Culturally, you're responsible for them. You may have to postpone or just target a two-year, maybe short, a journeyman kind of thing in anticipation of possibly needing to take care of your parents. I think that all goes into the factors in. And you should be very open and transparent with the missions organization that you do bear responsibility for your parents, that they're getting older, maybe getting to get sicker. You're going to be the one that's responsible, just so your missions agency knows. Language acquisition. Again, a general principle. Missionaries who learn the language well and develop a high degree of fluency have the most fruitful ministries and stay long term. Missionaries who learn the language well and develop a high degree of fluency have the most fruitful ministries and stay long term. That's a general principle. Missionaries who learn the language well and develop a high degree of fluency have the most fruitful ministries and stay long term. If this is true, and it's generally true, then take as much time as possible and needed to learn the language at the beginning of your missionary endeavors. Take as much time as possible and as needed to learn the language at the beginning of your missionary endeavors. You're called to be the church in another context. You're called to engage in evangelism and discipleship and church planting in another context, in another language. If you can't do more than baby talk, you can't evangelize. You can't disciple. You can't plant churches. Can God overcome that and give you an incredible gift and lead people to the Lord? Otherwise, absolutely. That's a supernatural reality. But in terms of our human responsibility, it's to work hard for as long as possible and as long as needed. And now missions agencies differ on this. Some say, you know, we're only going to give you 6 months. We know it'll take you 2 to 3 years to really learn the language. We're only going to give you 6 months. Try to negotiate. How about a year? Please, at least a year. How about 6 months? Do some ministry for 6 months and come back at it for 6 months for more language learning, something like that. Because you want to gain a certain fluency. There's various ways of language acquisition. One is language school, a formal, structured approach to learning another language. If you do that, stay away from other English language speakers. Yeah, they're the easy ones to work with and befriend at the language school. I know, I learned Italian in Firenze. I couldn't understand anything. I didn't understand the assignments for the next day. And so my attraction was to hang with my English-speaking friends. At least we could figure out together what we didn't know we were supposed to do. But it doesn't help with the language. There are informal or non-structured, kind of fluid approaches. LAMP, Language Acquisition Made Possible, is one thing that I did. You can do a combination of formal language school and then just informally targeting language tutors or language mentors. Find key language helpers who will work with you and rehearse with you and listen to you and correct you. Ask them to correct you. Ask them to be your friend by speaking hard truth to you. You can't say that way. And be ready to be humbled and humiliated. It's like becoming a baby again. When you can't say, please pass the salt and pepper, but you've got to, it's like being a baby again. And I've been through that. It is absolutely humiliating. I've misspoken on many occasions in Italian. I told a prayer seminar to get into couples and have sex together. And fortunately, someone says, you can't use that verb in that way, in that context. I meant, you know, pray in twos. Well, I didn't use the right verb. The prayer seminar became a very popular thing. I still remember going into the Uffizi Gallery. This is a world-class art gallery has some of the most important masterpieces in the world. And I remember listening to the incredible art historian and coming away with Rosso, this red line. I just learned one new word as he explained this incredible masterpiece. One word, that was it that I came away with. You want to get to the point where you're dreaming in your new language. It happened to me after about a year. I woke up and I told my wife, I said, I had a dream in Italian. It's when you know you've got another track in your mind so that you're not translating, but you're running with the track of the other language. And keep learning. Keep trusted friends, language tutors, who will boldly tell you, you can't say it that way, or you're mispronouncing, help you develop greater language acquisition. Comments about that? Yeah. Aren't your key, won't become your key people, yeah. No, not necessarily. I mean, my language tutors were even just like shopkeepers and all. They were convenient. They were right down, you know, from our apartment. And so I would just have regular speaking opportunities with them. They probably were not even believers. I don't know. I couldn't ask them, are you a believer? That could be. So your key people, your language mentors or helpers become your key. That could be. That would maybe be ideal, wouldn't it? Yeah. Not only do you have to acquire a new language, you have to acquire a new culture as well. And again, we've talked a little bit about adjusting well, but you're acquiring a new culture. You're becoming something other than just American. You're becoming an American and an Italian, an American and a Saudi. You're acquiring a new culture. And there are various systems for you to acquire a new culture. The one I used is called KEEPRA, K-E-E-P-R-A-H, KEEPRA, K-E-E-P-R-A-H. The word doesn't mean anything. It's just an acronym. K-E-E-P-R-A-H, kinship is the K. You want to figure out family structures. In Italy, the family structure was the most important reality for Italians. Everything focused around, centered around the family. So I had to figure out kinship. K is for kinship. The first E is for economics. How do finances roll? How does what's the economic system? In the day, we paid, you know, in lira, now there's the euro. You're learning economics. The second E is education. So how do children learn? What's the school system like? Or maybe there is no school system. What about high school? Is high school something like the equivalent of a college here? How about university? Things like that. The P is for politics. The P is for politics. What's the political system? Okay, I came from here, a Republican, Democrat, went to Italy. There's 23 different political parties from the whole spectrum, like almost impossible. But I had some friends who would regularly sit down with me and try to explain to me the political situation. So when the government fell, I was thinking, oh no, we're undone. And they go, well, the government falls every 6 months. They just exchange portfolios and everything keeps on functioning well. Political system, ours for religion. What's the major religion and the minor religions? How does Christianity relate to those? Are you in an Islamic context, a Buddhist context, Hindu context, animistic context? You've got to learn the religion. A is for arts, music, paintings, sculpture, dance, things like that, and health. What's the medical situation? Is it national? A national medical policy, things like that. KEEPRA, kinship, economics, education, politics, religion, arts, and health. study those various areas to acquire the language, and then adjust and learn to love the new culture. Yeah, there are things that are different. That doesn't make them wrong. And you're called to acquire that culture and live in it. Finally, and that's my point, I wanted to take almost our entire time, I see we are almost out of time, to show you, give you even a sense what it's going to take in order to become the church in another context. There's a lot of legwork that goes into this before you'll ever move overseas and before you'll ever acquire another language and a culture for you to be able to engage in what you want to do. So the nature of cross-cultural ministry is contextualization, the adaptation of the gospel and the church in different contexts or cultures. The adaptation of the gospel and the church in different contexts and cultures. You can't take an American church and plant it overseas. You've got to plant a church in that context that is contextually and culturally situated. The adaptation of the gospel and the church in different contexts or cultures. In Acts 2, 14 to 41, Peter preached his Pentecost sermon, the gospel, to a Jewish audience. And there are quotations from the Old Testament and allusions to the Old Testament. It's thick with the Old Testament because his audience was Jewish. In Acts 14, 8 to 18, Paul and Barnabas are preaching to the peasants, the farmers, the illiterates of a different context, a farming context. In Acts 14, 8 to 18. And he does a very simple presentation talking about the God who created the heavens and the earth and who providentially cared for them. This is in Lystra. In Acts 17, 16 to 34, Paul is preaching the gospel to the sophisticated, elite, educated philosophers of the Athenian society. He only makes allusions to two places in the Old Testament. He quotes from Aratus's poem and a poem called Phenomena by another man. So he adapts his message to the cultural context in which he found himself. We want to avoid two extremes then, the extreme of ethnocentric extractionism. Cool, don't use it tomorrow in Sunday school when you're teaching. The extreme of ethnocentric extractionism. This is excessive separation from one's cultural context. Excessive separation from one's cultural context. You move overseas, you go to Cairo, Egypt, but you live in a missionary compound, you don't ever meet Egyptians, you start an American worship service, you build an American steepled brick church, and you are completely withdrawn, separated from the cultural context. That's one extreme, the extreme of ethnocentric extractionism. The other extreme is the extreme of syncretism, substitution or dilution of biblical truth and practice by means of incorporation of unbiblical accretions. The substitution or dilution of biblical truth and practice by means of the incorporation of unbiblical accretions. Substitution or dilution of biblical truth and practice by means of the incorporation of unbiblical accretions. This, of course, is a raging debate in Islamic context. How much do believers continue to be Muslim and practice Muslim, or hold to Muslim theology and practice Muslim practices and all like that? The other extreme is syncretism. We conclude with this. Our task, as I see it, is missional church planting. We engage in evangelism and discipleship, ultimately with a goal of planting a church in a new context. The church is a missional church. It's identified as a body of divinely called and divinely sent ministers to proclaim the gospel of Christ and plant other church planting churches in another context. Identified as the body of divinely called and divinely sent ministers to proclaim the gospel and plant church planting churches in another context. I think when we get that vision, we will be a long way moving towards the fulfillment of the Great Commission.